It's Philosophy Talk.
Every nation now has a decision to make. Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
When we say somebody's a terrorist, we mean a number of different things. We mean the person who strapped on the bomb and went and blew himself up, or we mean the person who told him to go do that, or we mean the person who raised money for the terrorist organization, or the one who does their publicity, who does their video operations.
Are terrorists just ordinary people driven to extremes?
There are studies that show that the people who actually blow themselves up tend to be followers rather than leaders. But that applies to a lot of people in the world.
Is there a single profile of a terrorist?
What the terrorist, quote-unquote, does is many different things. So why would there be a single personality for many different roles?
Our guest is Martha Crenshaw, author of Explaining Terrorism, Causes, Processes, and Consequences.
Anatomy of a Terrorist.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the bay at Stanford University. That's where I taught philosophy for many years, and Ken, who's much younger, still does.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Well, today, we're looking at the anatomy of a terrorist.
Well, Ken, there's an old saying, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So exactly what do we mean? How do we spot a terrorist?
Well, you know, John, that old saying actually suggests to me that the words terrorist and terrorism, they're what philosophers call contested terms. Aren't these words so entangled in rhetoric and polemics and emotion that they're just philosophically useless, frankly?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think we can shape them into something useful. The key for defining terrorists is the root word terror. Terrorists are people who spread terror, and we particularly have in mind spreading terror by injuring and killing people, often lots of people, especially innocent people.
Oh, yeah, but what's the difference then between a terrorist and just a garden variety mass murderer by that definition?
Well, the terrorists we have in mind aren't in it for the thrill of it. They aim to cause fear and intimidation as a way of achieving a political goal.
Okay, but freedom fighters sometimes do that. Even some governments do. So I don't think your definition really helps us with our original problem.
No, I think you're wrong. I think that feature is a feature. It's not a bug. It's not a defect in the definition. Because terrorism and terrorists come in many flavors. Terrorism is a technique, and the cause for which it's a technique for promoting can be quite different. Take World War II, for example. That was a veritable cornucopia of terrorism. You had Franco, Stalin, and Hitler terrorizing their own populations. Resistance movements were happy to use terrorist techniques to fight the Nazis. And lots of states, the Allies, the so-called good guys, used terror bombing against cities and civilians.
Yeah, okay, I take your point. But you know, John, that's all ancient history. When Americans think about terrorists these days, we're thinking about people like the Boston Marathon bombers, or Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 hijackers he inspired, or suicide bombers in the Middle East. Let's focus on those kind of terrorists.
Well, fair enough. But Americans tend to think of terrorists as necessarily bad guys with bad causes. But plenty of supposedly good guys with supposedly good causes have resorted to terrorism, too. I mentioned the anti-Nazis in World War II. The ANC in South Africa in its early days was up to its neck in terrorist techniques. Or take contemporary eco-terrorists who are out to save the world, a reasonably good cause.
You're not denying that terrorism is an intrinsically bad thing, are you?
Well, maybe. I mean, it's just not so simple to evaluate either the morality or the rationality of the technique, terrorism, once you realize that sometimes good guys with good causes resort to it, too.
Ah, John, but sane rational people with a decent moral sense? They don't engage in terrorism, except maybe as an absolute last resort.
Well, take the 9/11 hijackers. It would be very convenient if we could just dismiss them as crazy. But in fact, most of them were well-educated adults who, prior to their terrorist acts, functioned relatively normally in society. No one identified them as nutcases before the fact. They don't seem to have been mere irrational pawns, and they certainly thought of themselves as doing something both moral and rational, even heroic.
Oh, come on. Do you really think, seriously, that flying those planes into those buildings can possibly be construed as a rational act of a normally functioning mind? Really?
Well, what is it for an act to be rational? What is it for you to do something rationally? It's a way of advancing your desires and goals on the assumption that your beliefs are true. So if a terrorist desires to advance a political cause, even one that we despise, and thinks that flying a plane into the World Trade Center will advance that cause, has that belief, that's his belief, then he's rational, right?
No, not at all. Because suppose you start out with some crazy beliefs and goals. Oh, maybe you believe that by strapping a bomb to your chest and blowing up lots of other people, you'll be instantly transported to heaven and you'll get to sleep with 70 virgins. Now, come on. If you start out with thinking things like that, I really don't care how calmly and coolly you reason from there and calculate costs and benefits. You're still just plain crazy, John. Irrational garbage in means irrational garbage out.
So we've identified a question. Are acts of terrorism always and inevitably motivated by crazy beliefs and desires? Or could a terrorist be acting on a reasonable assessment of the political situation in pursuit of a fairly reasonable goal?
Okay, and to help us understand whether it's reason or unreason that makes the terrorist tick, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to talk to a psychologist who studies the minds of terrorists. She files this report.
An Iraq War veteran walks into Fort Hood, a military post in Texas, and opens fire.
Sources confirm the shooter's name is 34-year-old Ivan Lopez. Now, we do know that he served 4 months in Iraq in 2011. We also know that he was under diagnosis for post-traumatic stress disorder.
The shooter's father said, quote, "My son could not have been in his right mind. He was not like this."
The most recent Fort Hood shooter appears to be a perfect example of disordered, disconnected.
Clark McCauley is an expert in terrorism and social psychology at Bryn Mawr College.
I am a student of man's inhumanity to man.
McCauley says lone wolf terrorists are different from those who join militant groups. The disordered and disconnected variety tend to engage in school shootings or attacks on movie theaters. That's the kind of terrorist we hear a lot about in the U.S. But there's another kind of lone wolf terrorist. Take, for example, Humam Khalil al-Balawi.
He's basically a Palestinian who feels that the Israelis have done terrible things to Palestinians. He's a physician. He's a surgeon. His specialty is children. And so he's working away in Jordan as a surgeon, working largely with children. Meantime, at night, he becomes a blogger, a fierce blogger.
Al-Balawi railed against Western powers that victimized Muslims, and he wrote admiringly of those who go and fight the West. At some point, the Jordanian intelligence found out about his radical blogging and called him into their headquarters.
This is a place from which people often do not get out very easily or entirely safe, but he's back in 2 days. Apparently unharmed, and he tells his wife he's going to Pakistan.
So off he goes with the full support of the Jordanian intelligence and the CIA. They think they've turned him, that he's going to make contact with the leader of Al-Qaeda.
He pretends to work for the West, but in fact he puts on a suicide belt and goes to the CIA base in Khost, where they're expecting great revelations from him about Zawahiri, and he blows himself up and kills basically all the high end of the CIA people that are in that base.
Here's a clip from a tape al-Balawi made right before the suicide bombing. He has a bomb strapped to him.
Look, this is for you. Snotwatch. It's a detonator. to kill as much as I can, inshallah. This inshallah. Is my dua. To kill you, to kill your partner, Jordanian partner.
Clark McCauley says Al-Balawi fits a special kind of lone wolf profile, the caring compelled. I know, strange that a terrorist would be described as caring, but remember, this man was a surgeon who worked with children.
He saw children being killed and maimed, especially by IDF attacks. And when he went off to Pakistan, he worked there also with children, many of whom had been injured and maimed by explosives with Made in USA on them. And so it was his special caring, his level of caring, that pushed him to action.
McCauley believes that if Al-Balawi were not forced to decide between his beliefs and betrayal, he'd still be posting rants on his blog, never straying into the field of suicide bombing. Terrorism wasn't in his DNA.
This is not a bad person. This is not somebody characterologically flawed. It's not a psychopath. It's not somebody who can't care for others. Rather, we would say this is somebody who cares so deeply that after a while, he can't avoid an opportunity thrust upon him to do something to help the cause and the victims that he cares about.
McCauley says Al-Balawi embodies the dark side of empathy, of compassion. He was sensitive, maybe more than we are, and that led him to commit acts with an extreme outcome. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thank you, Caitlin, for that sobering, roving philosophical report. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a senior fellow at the Friedman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. She's author of Explaining Terrorism, Causes, Processes, and Consequences. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Marta Crenshaw.
Martha, with all the interesting topics out there in the world, what got you interested in the psychology of terrorists?
I was a graduate student during the Vietnam War era, and I happened to be taking a seminar. I had to write a research paper for the seminar. All graduate students will sympathize with that. And I read a little book at the end of it. It said, you know, nobody's really studied terrorism. And I thought, well, there's a topic for me. I can study it. I never thought I'd still be studying it. But here I am.
So I guess by now there have been good, solid psychological studies of what makes terrorists tick, right?
There have been a lot of studies. How sound they are is a matter of some debate among people who study the subject. Since the 1970s, there have been studies. One, for example, said that terrorists were people who had an inner ear problem.
Oh, really? So do we have a nice profile of what makes a terrorist?
TSA has a behavioral profile. They say it's not a psychological profile per se, but something in your behavior, if you're nervous, sweating. Of course, you could also just be somebody who's never flown before. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to pin this down. The government would love to find a profile. It would be much easier to have a checklist, wouldn't it? We don't have a checklist.
So given this absence of a profile, I guess this is just a pointless activity that the government is engaged in. I mean, you know, trying to... I love to watch this TV show, Bones, and there's this psychologist on there, and Sweet, who's a profiler. He always goes to interview, and he helps Booth figure out, you know, what the real motivations are. Can't we do that? Can't the profiler sit down with one of these people and say, aha, I got you. You're a terrorist. You're about to blow up a building.
But when we say somebody's a terrorist, we mean a number of different things. We mean the person who strapped on the bomb and went and blew himself up, or we mean the person who told him to go do that, or we mean the person who raised money for the terrorist organization, or the one who does their publicity, who does their video operations. Number of different people, so why would there be a single personality for many different roles?
So it sounds like you agree with John. One, or are you saying something different? One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. There's no psychology of a freedom fighter. I mean, is that what you're saying, or is that different?
I'm saying something a little bit different, although I agree with John. It's a very subjective sort of judgment, and often when you call someone a terrorist, you're just trying to be pejorative rather than descriptive in a sort of neutral way. But the bias is in the eye of the beholder when you say one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. What I'm saying is that what the terrorist, quote-unquote, does as many different things.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. Our guest is Martha Crenshaw, author of Explaining Terrorism.
Can you imagine committing a terrorist act? Would you do so if you thought it was the only way to achieve some political goal? Say, to arouse awareness of global warming? That seems worthwhile. To advance independence for California? There's a slam dunk. Could terrorism in defense of liberty be a virtue?
Violence, virtue, and villainy, along with questions from our terrorized audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'm standing on your doorstep. Let me in. I'm leaning on the buzzer. Let me in. I've come to sound the warning. Let me in. The gypsies are coming. For God's sake, let me
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones, for evoking an earlier version of irrational fears of certain kinds of people, I guess. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is political scientist Martha Crenshaw. We're talking about the anatomy of a terrorist.
Could you ever see yourself committing a terrorist act? What would it take for you to do so? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Martha, okay, I get that there's not a single profile that empirical studies show us about the anatomy of terrorists, but they must teach us something about the range of people. I mean, are terrorists always insane, always gullible, always in some way or other in leave of their senses and reason, or are some of them just pure rational strategic thinkers? I mean, what does the empirical evidence show?
I think it shows that the only thing that unites people is personalities. Behind the label terrorism is simply the use of terrorism as a particular form of political violence. By and large, these are not people who are insane or mentally disturbed. The description that you heard earlier, this is not someone who was necessarily mentally disturbed. In many ways, as you could see from that description, it was a sort of random event that the Jordanian intelligence happened to arrest him and pushed him into this position. Often people join because their friends and their relatives have joined. It can be that simple.
So an inference I might draw from what you said is that, well, who are the terrorists? Well, they're any of us, potentially. I mean, any person in the right kind of circumstances might be pushed to do this. This is just something that human beings in certain kinds of extreme circumstances feel driven to do. Is that right? I mean, is it that anybody out there, the person standing at the microphone, could, in the right circumstances, be pushed to terrorism?
I think that's true.
Really? Come on, justify that. I mean, really? I can't see myself.
Well, look at this guy on the Roving Philosophical Report. He was a children's surgeon, for goodness sake, and a blogger. You know, I blog sometimes. Us bloggers are gentle people who want to, you know, count on words. But
okay, you think that's true, but convince, I mean, I'm a little skeptical about that. Convince me. Are there some studies? Are there some argument? Just convince me that...
That they are normal people, that they're ordinary people who don't exhibit any kind of psychiatric disorder.
Yeah.
Yes, insofar as we have information on who the people are, and say, let's take in particular suicide bombers and say as terrorists rather than just any average terrorists. Are they necessarily crazy? Well, first of all, they're sent by people who are extremely rational, and sometimes some of the people who strap bombs to themselves are people that we would think perhaps were deluded in some way. But others are intelligent people who always appeared to be thinking, kind, compassionate, and something happened that drove them to take this step. There are studies that show that the people who actually blow themselves up tend to be followers rather than leaders and might be the kind of person who's easily led. But that applies to a lot of people in the world, that they are followers. So you would not say that distinguished them necessarily from a whole lot of other people.
So John, in the opening, said about people who flew the plane into the Twin Towers. He said, and there's no reason to believe that they were irrational pawns. And it's about the suicide bombers. You said they're often followers rather than leaders. But, I mean, one might think that's an extreme of followership. That's a willingness to be an instrument, to be a pawn. And so there's something, at least, not completely normal about that. I mean, are they even on a... I'm looking for some scale on which they're extreme, even if we're all on that scale some way. Is that just a vain hope of mine, that they're extreme on some scale?
I think it's a vain hope. And to get back to your earlier question, the government would love to be able to say these types of traits put together point to this form of behavior, that they'll adopt violence, they'll become suicide bombers. There simply is not such a combination of traits out there.
So strategic thinking, just sort of instrumental rationality about how to meet your ends, of the sort John was saying. I mean, the circumstances may be odd. So this guy in the Roving Report faced a dilemma, either betray or live up to my empathetic commitments. And he resolved it in a certain way. I'm willing to give my life. But that was just kind of strategic rational thinking.
Every American kid who volunteers for World War II or the Korean War or even just to go... is willing to give their life for America. But suppose you don't have a well-organized state, but you still have a cause. That's not so different, is it?
Plus, you look at terrorism, we're talking about organized activity. There are lone wolves, quote-unquote, but they're a minority. And this case was unusual in many cases because he was one person. He was put in position to perform an act of violence by the Jordanian and American governments, and he turned on them. That's a fairly unusual sort of path to terrorism. Mostly people join organized groups, and they join in groups. They come from the same soccer club. They come from the same village in Morocco or Libya, and they join together. So it's very much a group activity.
So it sounds like terrorists are like gangs, but mm-hmm. with political causes mm-hmm. rather than turf wars over drugs and stuff like that. Is that right?
That's not a bad analogy. That's a very valid comparison.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the anatomy of a terrorist in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater with our guest Martha Crenshaw. We've got some questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk now.
Hi, my name is Barty, and I live here in Berkeley. So as we discuss this topic, I can't help but think of the definition of terrorism and what a terrorist is. And while we can come up with all of these symptoms, per se, of what a terrorist might do in terms of their tactics, I think about those symptoms or the tactics used and how they're used oftentimes in governmental ways and masked as national security. So the lines seem to get really, really fuzzy there. So what are your thoughts?
So what do you think, Martha?
The definition of terrorism is always problematic. I think that Ken said earlier, it's a contested concept. People are going to argue about it. So I like to think of it as one form of political violence, and political is important and violent is important. So both of those things. So intimidation without violence, I don't regard as terrorism. And I also tend to think of it as a systematic campaign of political violence. And it's a type of political violence that's highly symbolic. It uses what's actually smaller forms of actual violence. Not that many people are actually killed by terrorism, shocking though it is, but that's the purpose of it, is to shock, to outrage, to create horror, sometimes to terrorize, sometimes to arouse enthusiasm among people who sympathize with you, but meant for its shock value, so it attacks people in a way and at a time that's unexpected, usually defenseless victims, in order to make a psychological impact on the watching audience, which is all of us.
That's a great definition. What strikes me is that it's evaluatively neutral. And people don't, at least in this country, don't really use the word in an evaluatively neutral way. They use it as a term of dismissal. It's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. But what do you think about the fact that we, in ordinary speech, don't use this term in this evaluatively neutral way? Is that just a mistake or what? I mean, does it distinguish the purpose of scientific understanding from the ordinary discourse kind of thing?
I think that it's been sort of an uphill struggle because I've been trying to communicate that definition of terrorism for quite a large number of years. And my feeling is that I'll just keep trying to treat it as something that can be defined in an objective, scientific, scholarly, academic way, while being aware that the ordinary usage of the term is different. And in many ways, I'd love to just drop the term entirely and call it something else, but we can't do that.
But so when the government announces a war on terror, for example, are they not announcing a war on this just merely descriptive thing. I mean, they intend it to be loaded with evaluation. I mean, terror is a bad thing such that there ought to be a war on it. Do you think that's just manipulation of our consciousness for some ill reason? I mean, what's behind that? If you're right, if this is a kind of evaluatively neutral definition of terror, then it's kind of odd to have That would be like a war on ants or something like that, you know, rather than just the bad ants, you know, rather than a war on disease. You know what I mean?
Well, the U.S. goes to war against lots of things, poverty, drugs, any kind of social behavior we don't like, we go to war against it. So that was kind of something that was very evocative. All right, we don't like it, we go to war with it. And, of course, this was, I think, the adoption of the slogan, which was very quick after 9/11. I asked some people in government, why did you do this? Because I always thought this was a very dubious sort of thing. They said, we just meant to show that we took it seriously. We didn't really mean we were going to war, but then, of course, we did go to war. Mm-hmm. We really went to war. We didn't just talk about it. And when I told people we shouldn't talk about the war on terror, but probably all of you know it was called in the government the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. Yes, GWAT, mm-hmm. Acronyms. Talk about terrorizing people, acronyms. And then people said to me, but what's your bumper sticker? You had to have a bumper sticker.
So don't you think it was in part the great success of the earlier wars on abstract conditions, like the war on poverty and the war on drugs, that led to this? That's
that
a joke.
That must have been it.
Yeah, right. You're listening to Philosophy Talking. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. We've got more questions from that live audience. I hope they're not being terrorized. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Yeah, my name's Peter, and I live in Berkeley. And you just gave a definition of what counts as terrorism versus, I guess, what does not count as terrorism. And we heard this story about this person called Balawi. He didn't blow up a plane or set off a bomb in a crowded place. Mm-hmm. He killed the specific enemy, the CIA people in Pakistan. So I'm wondering, how does that qualify as terrorism? Doesn't seem to me that really fits your definition. He wasn't trying to scare people. He was trying to get back at these people who are actually working for his enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really very good point, and actually it crossed my mind as well. This was a Central Intelligence Agency at a military base in a war zone. A lot of people would say attacks on the military are not terrorism. So, for example, the 1983 bombing of the barracks, U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, some of us remember that quite well. It was the most deadly act of terrorism against Americans before 9/11. Many people would say that's not terrorism. This was a military unit. These are armed soldiers. They can defend themselves. And that it's only terrorism against people who are unarmed, whom we would call innocent, who are defenseless, who are not expecting it, have no way of defending themselves. So that's really still an open question. You could exclude attacks on armed combatants.
But see, that's if you really are just trying to be objective, scientific, evaluatively neutral. I think you're right that there's a definition of terrorism, some kind of neutral thing such that that probably isn't justly applied to it. But if you think, well, the people who attack RCIA and RCIA is legitimate, they're illegitimate, and you want a word that delegitimizes them, you use a word that carries delegitimizing forth. And it's really crucial, I think, in our politics and all that, that to call somebody a terrorist is to delegitimize them. Whether that's justified or not, I don't know. Do you think that's unjustified? Do you think that's just a kind of hiding from scientific truth kind of thing, or what?
I think you're quite right in terms of the purpose of the use of the term terrorism, which is always a term of opprobrium. And you find if you look back, say, to the anti-colonial movements, say, in Africa, the Mau Mau in Kenya against the British, we mentioned the ANC earlier, a tendency often on the part of very repressive authoritarian governments to call any opposition terrorists. You see this now with Russia and Crimea. Anybody who opposes us, well, you're a terrorist. That means you're totally illegitimate. There can be no protest, no opposition whatsoever. On the other hand, some users of what we might even objectively call terrorism were proud to call themselves terrorists, and that includes the Russian Revolutionary Movement of the late 19th century. Many anarchists, even some resistance fighters, were proud to say, yes, we terrorize the enemy.
So, see, but there's another use of terrorism that's not so evaluatively loaded, but it does track something. I mean, if your enemy's KGB or CIA alternate did that thing to your KGB or CIA alternate, you wouldn't call it terrorism. You would call it a sneak attack. You would call it sabotage. Mm-hmm. You would call it covert operations. Mm-hmm. But if a non-state actor did that, if an enraged, aroused individual did that, then you'd call it terrorism. So, I mean, there's another use of it that tracks the difference between what states are allowed to do and what individuals. And what do you make of that?
Well, I guess I see a distinction between an actor, a group of people, and it is typically a non-state actor, who tries to bypass the armed forces of the adversary in order to attack their civilians without warning. They do not want to engage the enemy, in military terms, whatsoever, because the struggle is an unequal one. It's what we call asymmetrical conflict. A government, a state, on the other hand, has many other alternatives. They have so much more power behind them that terrorism becomes a form of repression. And I think there is a distinction between violence from below and violence from above, and that power dimension is a very important aspect of it.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello, my name's Evan, and I live in Berkeley. I think the question of whether or not terrorism is moral turns on another question: do the ends justify the means? So do we have an answer to that question?
One response to that is, if the ends don't justify the means, what would? Because we often have means that by themselves wouldn't be a very moral thing to do. I cut off a child's arm. Well, that's not a very nice thing to do. Yes, but the arm had cancer in it, and it was the only way, given the technology we had, of preventing the spread of the cancer. Well, that end justifies that means. So in general, the abstract principle, does the end justify the means? I think the answer has to be yes. But then you get, does this particular end justify these particular means? And, you know, I don't want to be the person who holds the brief for terrorism, but it seems to me the argument is often much more convincing with respect to acts like the World Trade Center had a humongous effect, that if you had certain political goals, it was a good effect, and it cost relatively few lives compared to conventional warfare and the sorts of things that governments do all the time. So that's my answer.
But so, look, I think the powerful often want to rule out means that the less powerful are available to them. Mm-hmm. So I'm this band of people, and I want to get the United States out of my face. I want to embarrass them. I want to say, leave me alone. Go away. Right? I don't have an army. I can't drive them off the shores of this, that, or the other place. Okay, I say, I'm going to fly a plane into their building. They say, you can't do that. That's terrorism. Okay, so what am I supposed to do? So, okay, yeah, they're not justified by your lights, but who says you get to just pick what are my justifiable ends? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not a philosopher, but I think Albert Camus said, what justifies the means, if not the end? So I guess I disagree with you, John. But if you look back to the early history of terrorism, and you look again at the Russian Revolutionary Movement, you see that a faction within the overall movement that used terrorism, because not everybody agreed that it was the right thing to do, they said, we're more moral than the others because we're sacrificing ourselves. We're not asking people to come into the streets to be mown down by gunfire. We are standing up for them by trying to assassinate the Tsar. Now, we might kill 10 or 15 other people in the bomb, but they weren't our intended target. Our intended target was the Tsar. If we just remove him, everything would be better. But, of course, they removed the Tsar, and a worse one came along.
So I think one thing we can say is that using an end, a noble end, to justify an intrinsically disgusting means is a process fraught with moral risk.
Well, that is certainly true. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the anatomy of a terrorist with political scientist Martha Crenshaw.
How do you think we can eliminate or at least reduce terrorism? How about not provoking terrorists? Or maybe finding and killing every single potential terrorist? Or maybe educating them or re-educating them?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Him. He's wild in sorrow. He's riding and hiding his pain. Don't fight him, don't spy him. Just wait till tomorrow. Maybe he'll ride on again.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones, for reminding us. It's always been my policy, be careful of redheaded guys from Montana. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Martha Crenshaw, author of Explaining Terrorism. And we're thinking about the anatomy of a terrorist in front of a live audience, and we've got a question from that live audience now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sarah.
My name is Amanifu. I'm from Wisconsin. I would offer that a terrorist is simply a reactionary. And the solution is always justice. And the terrorist thrives in a situation where there's an absence of justice. What do you say to that?
What do you say to that?
Well, I think in some circumstances, you're absolutely right that particularly now, if we look in a lot of Asia, Central Asia, South Asia, Africa, the Middle East, oppositional groups that use violence do thrive where there's an absence of justice. And not just justice, but all the institutions and apparatus of justice, functioning and fair police and judiciary, everything that goes with the implementation of justice. But on the other hand, we saw terrorism in Western Europe and the United States in the 1970s and early 1980s. These were functioning democracies. People had other alternatives. Violence was not the only alternative for these groups, and I'm thinking of groups like the Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof Gang or Red Army faction in Germany. And still they resorted to terrorism because they were fundamentally anti-democratic movements.
So I think it's right that terrorists often, maybe always, operate under the self-description of seekers of justice in a context in which they perceive the absence of justice. But here's the problem. Justice is a contested thing. Mm-hmm. Who's justice? Mm-hmm. Part of me is like a moral relativist, but if we have this is our canons of justice, we're not all going to always agree. Mm-hmm. Right? The democratic societies with elected governments, with global ambitions, aren't going to always agree that we should be out of the face of those people in the Middle East. They think, well, you should be out of the face, and it's a question of justice. But who's justice? I mean,
it seems to me that justice is often leads to causes that then are supported by terrorism. I mean, like in South Africa, for example, and certainly could have been a lot more, I would think, justified terrorism in the United States during slave times, although maybe there was, and our knowledge of it has been suppressed. Certainly if a person had managed to fly a plane into the Reichstag during World War II and killed Hitler, and actually virtually a suicide bomber did try to kill Hitler, we would think that was very worthwhile. So justice and oppression are often involved. I don't know what Timothy McVeigh had in mind. There it seemed like racism maybe played a larger role. My question, though, now is Americans often think that radical Muslim ideology, that is a religious motivation as opposed to a justice motivation, is behind a lot of Islamo-terrorism. Another view might be, no, those feelings are exploited by people, but the real things that are motivating it from within the organization are probably less religious than political. What's your sense of religion and terrorism?
That's also another hot and contested sort of topic. It begins really in the discussion of terrorism around about the time of the Iranian Revolution. And that's, of course, still timely today, as someone who participated in the takeover of the embassy has been denied a visa to come be Iran's ambassador to the UN. So it's still very much a live political topic. But the notion that people are motivated by, first of all, a religious rather than a political imperative, and second, a sort of corollary assumption that if so, if it's religious, it's apocalyptic and irrational, and therefore these are people that you cannot deal with. They are not the rational, calculating political types that maybe you could strike a deal with. This is now morphed from sort of an anti-Shia argument that it's Shia Islam to an anti-Sunni argument, and it's jihadism, and it's Sunnis. And suicide bombings began with Shia movements in Lebanon, spread to purely secular movements like the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, and now have been picked up by Al-Qaeda and have become the hallmark of Al-Qaeda. So it's hard to say they're driven by religion in that case.
But I think there's a deep thing, a fact about human life that is uncomfortable. That human beings are potentially really radically divided from each other. I mean, the 20th century didn't teach us that. I don't know what can. Because, you know, one of the things that the 20th century was, I like to think of, is as an object lesson in humanities, our roving philosophical reporter, he said, mm-hmm. I study man's inhumanity mm-hmm. to man. Mm-hmm. I think the 20th century taught us that human beings have a massive and deep capacity to think of one another as yesterday's garbage. That those other people have no mm-hmm. more standing than mm-hmm. yesterday's garbage. They are in my way. Whatever it takes to get them out of my way, I will do that. Right? And so it does go back to everybody claims justice is on their side, but you add that deep divisions that human mm-hmm. beings have, whether because of religion mm-hmm. or politics or whatever. You know, I knew people when I was in graduate school, they were trying to recruit me into the Communist Party, right? And they really were about the overthrow of the U.S. government mm-hmm. by whatever means necessary. I used to have these arguments with my friend Nick, who worked at this restaurant with me. He really wanted to overthrow the U.S. government. That was what he really wanted to do, by whatever means.
Mm-hmm. So Martha, since 9/11, we've had this war on terrorism. And I think there's some worthwhile defensive measures that have been taken. I mean it, like, for example, locking the pilot's door seems like a mm-hmm. good idea. And I'm sure, I'm happy enough for the TSA to paw me and look at my laptop. But in terms of eradicating or reducing the number of terrorists or the number of terrorists that are targeting the U.S., it doesn't seem to be working. Perhaps the opposite. So I'm going to make you czar for a day, head of the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, all the vast powers of the United States, United Nations, and Europe. What are you going to do to reduce terrorism?
I'm going to return to something I said earlier, which is that this is very much a local problem in many societies. And that, unfortunately, does not lead me to a good, simple, easy answer as to what you can do. But you need to strengthen judiciary, police, anti-corruption mechanisms, religious tolerance in a lot of different societies around the world. And the problem is the divisions that you spoke of, Ken, are so real. They're real here, where you could argue with someone about joining the Communist Party or not, and he wouldn't have killed you for not joining, right. Whereas in other societies, they would have killed you for not joining, where there simply was no rule of law. And the links now between terrorism and sectarianism are very, very alarming to me. And I'll point to an example like Nigeria and also contemporary Iraq, where now that we've withdrawn, violence is now up to the levels it was during the famous surge. I don't have an easy answer to an enormously intractable problem, which is not very satisfying.
Yeah. Do you think, and I'm trying to put this in a neutral way, but do you think in the long run it would be a good idea for the U.S. to keep its nose out of other people's business?
Are you asking me to endorse isolationism?
No, just the idea that, you know, if the British and the Germans are having a fight, we should get involved. If the Shiites and the Sunnis are involved, they just need some good American common sense to set this straight and keep the oil flowing. Would it help if there was a little less of that going on?
I think that that we may be moving in that direction as a reaction to our two interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq and also Libya, and then our observation of what's going on in Syria. I think it would be a mistake to go too far in that direction. I think, for example, that our intervention in Afghanistan could have had a positive outcome. I'm not sure it will now. So I wouldn't want to see, we tend to pivot from one extreme to the other. And I wouldn't want to see us pivoting totally. I would like to see us use more judgment when we do intervene.
I agree with you, but I also think I really want to stress how much I disagree with John. The world the world is massively interconnected. There is no going back. There is no making the footprint of the major industrial powers small in the world. How is that going to possibly happen? We rub a lot of people the wrong way. I'm not sure we could. There is a way to not rub a lot of people the wrong way. I don't know what a country would be like that rubbed nobody the wrong way. And people are empowered and organized, and it's not going to get better.
Yeah, but the United States had power in the 20th century that was amazing. And to me, it was often motivated by incredible naivete. If we just go over to Europe, we can get all this stuff straightened out on the basis of Wilson's 14 points, and things will be fine. Ooh, whoops, World War II. You know, if we just get rid of that Islamic ruler in Iran and put a nice, sensible guy like the Shah in, you know, oil and peace in the Mideast forever. We just push Kuwait back and, you know, That'll take care of things. Oops, we spawned a completely successful terrorist. So that's my view.
I want to give you the last word. You got a brief last word here?
I'll just return to that. I think we simply need to use better judgment about when we intervene and when we don't. And we need to make sure that we don't create a bigger problem by removing someone who we objected to and thought somehow automatically the next generation of rulers would be much better.
So, Martha Evans, thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Martha Crenshaw. She's a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. She's author of Explaining Terrorism, Causes, Processes, and Consequences. So, John, what are you thinking now?
Well, I think the person who asked about means and ends made a very crucial contribution. I mean, oftentimes, not just in terrorist acts, but in war in general, we really lose focus of how terrible the means are, right? The people who die in war are quickly forgotten, whether they're civilians or soldiers or anybody else, whereas whatever noble end the war was fought for continues to live in history books forever. So that's my view.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of a pessimist here. You're usually the pessimist, and
I'm the optimist.
Yeah, well, I'm usually, because I just think this stuff is never going away. I don't ever think it's going to be kumbaya, happy, happy world.
No, but the world will end.
Yeah, I know. But so we'll all end together. That's the problem. The terrorists and their victims will go down together. But, you know, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a man who commits violent acts of speed. Ian Scholz, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz, Jesse and Frank James started out as Confederate guerrillas during the Civil War, fighting with Bloody Bill Anderson. These ruthless rebels killed anybody in Kansas and Missouri that looked like they were for the Union. Hundreds of people, some of them in actual pitched battles. Then Bill Anderson was shot down, breaking up the gang, so to speak. A piece of string was found on Anderson's body with 53 knots, each knot supposedly representing somebody he'd killed. After the war, the James boys went into robbery, beginning with a bank in Liberty, Missouri in 1866. Jesse himself did not participate in that one, as he was still recovering from a chest wound and couldn't ride. His fame began in 1869, when he robbed a bank in Gallatin, Missouri, killing a cashier he mistook for the officer who had killed Buddy Bill Anderson during the war. Jesse's declaring it revenge, even though he killed the wrong guy, and the daring escape he and his brother made afterwards got him ink for the first time. John Newman Edwards, a rabid pro-Confederate editor of the Kansas City Times, championed Jesse as a poor Southern boy persecuted by Republicans. His paper compared the James gang's robberies to knight-errantry. Of their war experiences, he wrote, quote, their long and reckless scouts and forays and their riotous jollity all combined to form a chapter without parallel in the annals of America, unquote. Riotous jollity, like galloping into towns with the scalps of executed dead men on their saddles. Whatever. For years, the bandits could count on food and shelter from sympathizers. Jesse had people convinced he was Robin Hood, even though he stole from everybody and kept everything. Jesse knew how to play the victim, often writing letters to the editor protesting his innocence, or even, when admitting guilt, not really confessing. This is from a letter published in 1872. Quote, what have we done to be hung for? It is true that I shot a little girl, though it was not intentional. And if the parents will give me their address, I will send them money to pay her doctor's bill. And as to Mr. Wallace, I never intended to kill him. I only shot to make him let go my friend. If I had been so disposed, I could have shot him dead. Just let a party of men commit a bold robbery, and the cry is, hang them! But President Ulysses S. Grant and his party can steal millions, and it's all right, unquote. This psycho finally believed his own press, riding deep into Yankee territory in 1876 with an eight-man gang to rob a bank in Minnesota. Well, the Swedes up there did not roll over in fear, but shot them up pretty good. Only Frank and Jesse James got away. They never quite recaptured their former outlaw glory. Even their sympathizers had had enough. There were a couple more robberies, but there was also a price put on Jesse's head, collected by that coward Robert Ford. Ford tried to tour with a show as the man who killed Jesse James, but because he shot Jesse in the back, it wasn't that popular. He wound up being killed himself by a man who became known, of course, as the man who killed the man who killed Jesse James. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sakalauer-Shane, and Nabila Abdallah.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar. Carola Kreitmeyer is our performance consultant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders,
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.